just having an interview with Suriani, and Suriani is a madam at a very high-class Balinese brothel. And I'll just ask Suriani to say a few words. Say hello to some of the Australians that will be listening. Suriani, you're talking to them.
Oh, yeah.
You're talking to them.
Suriani.
Yeah.
Hello, my name is Suriani. I love you, elderling Australia.
Now, this is an interview with one of the gentleman clients here. Now, which country do you come from, sir?
From mana, daerahnya mana?
From Banyuwangi.
Banyuwangi, Jawa.
Banyuwangi.
Yes. Is from that Java.
That's from Java.
Java.
You look as though your father was Chinese.
Chinese, yes.
Is your father from China?
Yeah.
I see. A long time ago.
Yeah.
And what are you enjoying here? Is this you're enjoying a massage and all the special services?
Yeah.
Very good massage?
Very good massage. Bagus massage.
Bagus.
I don't know. Kamu bagus massage, yeah.
And
yes, yes, good.
Very good. And he comes here often?
Oh, yeah.
Does he come here often?
Yeah.
Every day?
Yeah.
Every day?
Every day.
It must be very bagus.
Yeah,
yeah. Bali
bagus.
Yeah, Bali, yes.
Yeah, bagus.
And
Bali bagus. I don't know speak English. Maybe yes, because his little name. No.
No
speak English.
I see, what is his name?
Maybe yes, nice
speaking. Nice speaking, yes.
Maybe I won't go to Australia, Germany, Singapore. Yes. I can speak English, no money.
No money, that's the problem. But
you have money?
I have just
okay.
A little bit.
A little bit.
You think just enough, yeah. I see. Now, you have found a way of earning money, and if you make some money this way, will you go to Australia and Germany and all those other countries?
Thank you.
When would you go to Germany?
Oh, maybe a sister, Germany, darling Germany.
I see. You like German? German men?
No, I like Australia.
You like Australian men?
I like Australia. Oh. Australia nice.
They're nice.
Yeah.
Always smiling? Always happy. Suriani, I know that during the day you run this high-class establishment, but what actually do you do at night? If we can sort everyone out here just for a moment, I'd like to ask you what... What you do at night, Suriani?
Maybe I won't go to Bali Bistro.
I see. Every night you work at Bali Bistro.
Oh, 9 o'clock.
From 9 o'clock. Till what time?
Yeah. 1,000 rupiah.
And that's what it costs for a man to dance with you. It costs 1,000 rupees.
1,000 rupees.
That is about Australian dollar. $2.50 Australian.
Yeah.
For a man to dance with you for 1 hour.
Okay.
And then during that time, you don't let any other men dance with you. Is that right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Bagus.
Bagus dancing.
Bagus dancing.
All sorts of dancing.
Yeah, Bali Bistro bagus.
Yes.
Yeah. Dada, like Bali Bistro, no, dan pasar.
Not too good.
Bali Bistro good.
Bali Bistro is better than
Hayat, Budang Sing good, yes. Matahari Hayat.
Is that good?
Si saya ikut it.
No.
No.
But still, Bali Bistro.
Slow dancing.
I see. You. This is why you are very good at dancing, because you have all this practice.
Yeah.
I see.
Just
and.
Stop this moment.
Suriani, you have a very beautiful voice.
Yeah.
What I'd like to ask is, can you sing an Indonesian song?
Yeah.
Just sing a little Indonesian song for us. You sing now.
Mm.
Now.
Mm.
You come and just sing your favorite Indonesian song.
Yeah. I don't know. No, like music, no.
Oh, you don't?
No. Suruh nyanyi, aku tidak mau.
Could you sing a little one?
No.
Simple.
Understand. Indonesian.
Yeah.
Oh itu, silakan tangannya.
It would go on very nicely.
Ayo lagi sedikit.
Just nice and quiet.
Ya, samaan. Ah, itulah.
Sorry,
okay.
Sorry.
Utang.
Gimana ada kamu?
Correspondents, please withdraw my name from your mailing list. And that was fairly light-hearted, and it really was at that time. I didn't have time to give them proper answers. Then I went for another year without hearing from them again, and I thought, wonderful. But then I got another letter. It sort of said, it was a pretty blunt letter. It said, I think, go directly to jail or something.
Yeah, so, stop.
But still, I've got involved in a fairly long philosophical debate about whether one should finance one's own destruction. When I see most of the tax money being spent by government in doing the opposite to what they're supposed to be doing, and that's protecting us.
That does happen regularly, yes. Now, nobody could dispute that.
Sooner or later, we must protest, and there's a very wide-spreading tax revolt movement in Australia. You might see some bumper stickers around in various states that says, taxes are revolting, why aren't you?
Yeah, I've seen those.
And this
I've
is a good message, and we should think on this. Because
yes, but then aren't you going to have absolute chaos if everyone refused to pay their taxes?
No, limited government. We are already paying our taxes with everything we buy.
Yeah, I've got to go along there. I think we're one of the highest tax countries in the world, aren't we?
You really have got to go overseas to find out how bad it is here. Mm. Now, for instance, in this, in January's edition of Reader's Digest, in every edition overseas except the Australian edition, there was a beautiful article on Australia and just what has happened with excess taxation and reduction of incentives in Australia. But they did not print that in the Australian edition because we're very sensitive about
it. Well, that's censorship, isn't it, basically, which is telling us what we're to read and what we're not to read about our own country. Well, that
we really are restricted in what we can read.
All right, what are your alternatives, not talking about tax, but say to government, what do you put forward in your opinion, Ron, and also where do you think Australia's headed if we go on the way we're going?
Well, as I said, we've got the fourth weakest currency in the world. It's there's only three worse, the international currencies, the Italian lira, the pound sterling, and the Greek drachma. And then comes the Australian dollars. All the other currencies are better because there's no discipline on government. They can get involved, they can do anything, they can spend as much as they like, and they can print unlimited amounts of money. And this is just, now, if for instance, 18 months ago you had have taken your Australian dollars and put them into Swiss francs at no interest 18 months ago, today you'd be 45% better off. That is the measure of where we're going, and it's still going that way. There's no change.
Well, we'll have to watch it. I mean, it happened to pre-war Germany, didn't it, with the printing of the money I think you were paying.
We're on the brink of that. Once we get up to 20% inflation, then there's only one way to go, and that's hyperinflation.
And unfortunately, the inflation just doesn't seem to be improving in any way.
No.
Where the other countries are mastering it.
I was in. I was asked by a finance journalist in Taiwan 18 months ago. He asked me a question. He said, "Mr. Manners, in Australia, why does your government pay people not to work?"
Very true.
This little Oriental guy just was fascinated why we do things like this. They don't do it, and they don't have inflation. And then I said, "Well, look, you've asked me a question. Can I ask you one? And why is it that in Taiwan you don't have inflation?" He said, "Well, it's fairly simple. We've got a reserve bank the same as you have. We've got a government the same as you have. We've got a government who makes promises and wants to sort of be popular and wants to spend your money on being popular. But above the reserve bank is a committee of six Chinese businessmen. And if the reserve bank, because the government wants to print 20% more money, the Chinese businessmen say, okay, what was our increase in productivity? And the answer might be 3%. And these Chinese businessmen say to the Reserve Bank, you can print 3% more money. Forget about the other 17% of dreams, because that's not on. That's what we need in Australia.
It's very interesting,
discipline.
Isn't it? I wonder if there are people listening who'd like to have a word with Ron Manners, because some of his views are a bit startling and a bit, you would almost say way out. But at the same time, I can see the truth of it.
Nan, it really is not way out, it's logic.
Yes, it is logical, but I think that if we have people call in and if they want to ask you any questions, will you be happy to answer them?
I'll do my best.
Jolly good, all right.
267-1486, 267-1486. 1486 is the number to ring.
This is Muzak. But there's more to Muzak than meets the ear. Because apart from providing background music, Muzak are experts in paging systems too. Muzak can provide general and selective paging facilities, intercoms, and Muzak are specialists in hotel motel paging services. When you want your call to be heard, call Muzak on 267-1461. Muzak, the background music and paging specialists. 267-1461.
Salisbury Primary School will be conducting a centenary celebrations tomorrow, Thursday, Friday and Saturday and also Sunday. Tomorrow there'll be an open school from 11 till 3. Parents are invited to have lunch with children. On Thursday there'll be a train trip and picnic, $1 for children, $2 for adults. Friday there'll be sports, Saturday a Mardi Gras, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. with a ball at Parabanks on Saturday night. On Sunday there'll be church services. If you live in the southern suburbs and you're interested in singing and dancing, the Galaxy Musical Society at O'Halloran Hill is always welcoming new members. Now they're particularly looking for men who can dance or sing for the next production, Oklahoma. Just go along to rehearsal. 7:30 Wednesday night in the O'Halloran Hill Technical College Theatre, Majors Road, next to the drive-in, or phone Kath Cousins on 276-1374. 276-1374. 10 minutes to two. We'd like to offer two prize recipe fruitcakes to a lucky listener in the Rosewater area. If you live at Rosewater, you can tell us, and you can tell us in which store you've seen prize recipe fruitcake on display. Ring 5DN on 267-1461, 267-1461 with the correct answer, and you will win two delicious prize recipe fruitcakes. Certainly not to be sneezed at. We had a winner a while ago, too, from the Paraka area. Congratulations to Mr. Stan Mullins, who was able to tell us that in Paraka, prize recipe fruitcake is on display at Tom the Cheap. Beautiful day, 21 degrees in Adelaide with Ken Dickon and Nan Whitcomb. And our guest this afternoon is Ron Manners, and Margaret would like to talk to Ron. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Ken. Hi, Nan.
Hello.
Hello.
Ron's listening to you there.
Yes.
Okay, sure.
Look, Ron, as far as you've gone, yes, fair enough. How do you feel about the way, just take, say, South Australia for argument's sake, they spend money on some things that really are not necessary, like, for argument's sake, the Malaysian Week, which was advertised as $50,000. It's now been proved that they've spent $150,000. That's on paper. And today there's an article in the paper from our First Lady saying she's disappointed in our attitude towards it and said what a wonderful time they had in Penang. But that also cost $211,000, and that is a fact on paper in the government things. Now, do you think we're too apathetic about these things too?
Margaret, the answer is fairly simple, that if I'm employed by people, as our politicians are employed by us, and I have a budget of so much to spend and something like that, and I think, and if I overspend it three times, as that was the case that you just mentioned, then I can expect to be reprimanded. I might not lose my job, but I might be told, well, that's once, Ron. and that's where we've lost, our priorities are somewhat inverted here. We forget who's working for who.
Yes,
we forget the real, this public servant bit, you know, is almost a joke. They are running our lives now. We really should be running their lives.
That's right. And can I ask you something about taxation?
Please do.
I got a letter from them because they didn't... I sent in some... This is 74, 75, right?
Yes.
They sent me a letter about a very small amount of $12.46, right? Then they got me in and we went all over 74, 75 again. They told me that I would get money back. And they also got me to sign two affidavits to the effect of the reason why I didn't do these both these things, which I had done, but which didn't arrive, you see. Now, if you sign an affidavit, am I right, and it is not accepted, you are liable to be jailed, right? If they don't accept it as a fact.
They do send people to jail for some things. Now, they don't send people to jail in Australia for not paying tax.
No,
that's okay, but they do send people to jail for telling lies.
Yeah, for
perjury. Now, you haven't told a lie, but if you've just refused to supply certain information, then they cannot send you to jail for that.
Because they just scrubbed it. They got me to sign it, and then they said, oh, we don't, that's just a formality.
Okay, well,
and they're fining me $46 for it.
Now, what is the charge? Why are they fining you?
For late return.
No, I'd have to look at the specific act. They may have a point, and if they find you, that was it. But perhaps it would have been better for you to supply no information at all, because I know the tax department expects us to provide all sorts of information for the tax department. Now this is quite wrong, because you shouldn't be expected to aid and abet a thief when he walks into your home. You shouldn't have to take him by the hand and take him to which drawers you've got your valuables in and things like that. This is why we really lie down and surrender, because when these people ask us for our help to destroy ourselves, we usually give it, and this is absolutely surprises me no end.
They now set told me that I can go in again and start all over again.
What if you do, don't cooperate with them, because that's cooperating with criminals, really, in many ways.
Oh dear, I do. That's strong stuff, isn't it?
Oh, it's got it.
Well, good luck, Margaret. Don't get yourself into too much trouble, though, will you?
Margaret, the one thing that you should remember is they don't really like people going to court, to the legal courts. Because there's always a chance that the people will win, and this is what the taxation department cannot afford. So very rarely do they take you right to the court.
Oh, I see.
This is what I found.
I shouldn't like it anyway.
Well, it's quite enjoyable if you've had a bit of experience in court. It's quite an enjoyable experience, really.
Thanks for your call, Margaret.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Margaret.
Bye bye. Have the result of that protest now after race 5 at Moonee Valley. Protest dismissed. 11-2 is 7, as called by John Russell and Waiters, right, a time of 2:15.4. First number 11, Money Honey. Second number 2, Mr. Aggressive. And third number 7, Lord Savino. Protest dismissed, and Waiters right for those numbers. Time of 2:15.4.
Stanley James, this is your mother. I've just heard you've left Glenis again. Stanley, you have to realise that not everyone can cook as well as I can. Glenis is a good girl, she tries. So I've shown her how to turn a stew into a delicious casserole. It's called the making of a great casserole. It's all the herbs, spices, seasoning and thickness she needs to make the sort of meals your mum used to make you. So stop being stubborn like your father and go home. Oh, but son, be careful on the roads.
There are many things in life that require a good deal of practice, like pizza making. When throwing pizza dough, if you don't follow through properly, the dough can hit the fan with dire consequences. To help make a more successful pizza, Big Sister have a quick and easy pizza kit. Easy to mix dough base that needs no throwing and a complete topping. All you supply is a bit of time and the water. Big Sister Pizza, a nice Italian base with a good Australian topping.
Hello, Ted.
Hello there. To Ron.
Yes, he's right there.
Good morning, Ted.
Morning. Look, I'm nearly 70, and I remember Winston Churchill a long, long time ago, probably before you were born, saying what you just said, and I'm congratulating you. And this is what I was saying about the Taiwanese way of going on. You work on a percentage, no higher.
Sure. Flat rate of tax, the progressive, as we call it, income tax, was a Marxist device that we've somehow accepted in most of our countries.
Yes, I
and it's
know.
A quite, it quite, it's an anti-work tax to prevent people from being productive. Well, that's not the way to get our country off the ground, is it?
I remember when Churchill was saying this in 1932, that's the way that England could get out of the depression they had at that time, and they got out of it, just exactly that way.
Great.
Oh, that's very interesting, Ted. Thank you very much for your call.
Bye-bye, Ted.
Bye.
Hi, Peter. You'd like to speak to Ron, would you?
Yes.
Go ahead, he's
Peter,
listening.
Peter, good morning.
You were saying that the government in Australia causes all of the inflation?
The government is the prime cause for inflation, yes.
Yeah, well, I was doing matriculation last year, and in the theories, it's caused by three different things, really. The wages, prices, and the government as well.
Yes, I do honestly believe that wages and prices are a result of inflation. They're not the cause for it. You've got to have the fuel in there to get it going, and all these other prices and wages rise as a result of inflation.
Yeah, well,
if we didn't have any inflation, people wouldn't really be pushing for higher wages. They wouldn't need higher wages as much as they do now. I don't blame people for wanting higher wages. They've got to have it to live with inflation going the way it is. Once again, prices have got to go up if wages go up. But if the government does not inflate the currency, we will not have inflation, and that is just a fact that cannot be argued with. We had a visiting Nobel Prize economist in Australia last year, Professor Hayek, and he said, it is bad enough that your government is destroying your money. That's bad enough, but he said, far worse, your government has made it illegal for you to protect yourself against those government actions. And he had it right on the head. That's the cause. Government is the cause of inflation.
But in Japan, they have the government spends like crazy, and that causes an increase in their productivity, and that counters for their inflation.
Well, I know Japan has inflation, and that you've explained why Japan has inflation. It's not one of the best currencies in the world, and you know, they have inflation, so we can't hold up the Japanese yen as an ideal currency to hold.
No, but even so, they have a pretty, their standard of living has increased a hell of a lot over the last, you know, decade or so.
Sure, they don't have the taxation rates that we have in this country. There's no reason for them not to work. There's a very good reason for us not to work.
Yeah.
They don't pay people not to work there either.
Thank you for your call, Peter.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye, Peter.
Bye.
Mooney Valley Race 5, first number 11, Money Honey, $1.25, 75 cents. Second number 2, Mr. Aggressive, $1.85. Third number 7, Lord Savino, $1.15. Repeating M Race 5, number 11, $1.25, 75 cents. Number 2, $1.85. Number 7, $1.15. Totals 20 for $5 even, scratching number 1.
Time, it's just gone 2 o'clock. Unfortunately, there was a race posted for 2 o'clock, but there is a little bit of a delay, so we might hang on, have the race, and then we'll do the news afterwards. Ron, thank you very much for coming in and putting forward your views. You've no doubt created a lot of interest in many people's minds.
It's been a pleasure meeting
I'm
you.
I'm sure you have. You've certainly created a lot of interest in my mind. Every time I do anything or pay anything now, I'm going to start thinking about it.
Think twice, that's right.
Thank you for coming
in. What you're saying, basically, just before you do go, you don't think people are really aware of their rights? Do you think a lot of the trouble causes stems from this?
Absolutely. And this is one of the problems when the government has taken over the education industry. We are only taught what they want us to be taught. And there's a lot more to learn. And I'm learning fast.
Thank you, Ron.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Well,
this is an interview in Hong Kong on April the This is an interview in Hong Kong on April the 26th with John Nye, an Australian who left some 7 years ago. John, I'd like to ask some details of your background and what activities you were involved in Australia before you left, and just what has happened to you since leaving.
I was a technical school teacher in Melbourne, Victoria, teaching art and design. I came to Hong Kong where I began working as a graphic designer on a freelance basis initially. And then went into art direction with a mail order company, working mainly into the United States. I set up a photographic studio to service the graphic design studio. And from there I went very heavily into photographic work for about 2 years. I went to Singapore, got post as creative director with an advertising agency for a year, and then returned to Hong Kong, where I established my own photographic studio.
John, what actually caused you to leave Australia 7 years ago?
There are several reasons, actually. When I was at art school in Melbourne, I studied with an Asian student, and after we graduated, I travelled through most of Southeast Asia with that gentleman. On our way through Hong Kong, I met my friend's cousin, who I eventually married, a Hong Kong girl, who came to Australia. She lived in Australia for 2 years. We were married in Australia, actually. While I was teaching, I found that the conditions of the contract were never fulfilled by the education department, and I tried on several occasions to have the situation adjusted, and eventually we decided that we might make a move to Hong Kong. My wife was not particularly happy living in Australia, which was an added reason. Finally decided that we should leave.
John, what aspects of the, in relation to your job as a technical school teacher, triggered off your departure from Australia?
Right, went through the system of holding a studentship, which is a sort of government contract where you agree to work for a certain period of time after graduation for a certain salary. However, after I graduated, I was missing on one or two subjects which I had to catch up on, which I did. But when I caught up on those subjects, instead of adjusting the salary to the level that was agreed on before I signed the contract, it was always 1 or 2 years behind the other students. And then there were reasons, I guess, why I could understand that situation. But then the government, without any reason at all, started recruiting semi-qualified people at a higher salary because an award had come in the meantime, and they didn't adjust the existing staff salaries. They started the adjustment with the new recruits, and then also they started recruiting overseas, and the same situation continued on. I just couldn't seem to get it adjusted. I think this affected many people at that stage.
John, I think a problem you mentioned of the government on the one hand rejecting some of their own qualified people, and on the other hand recruiting people from overseas to fill vacancies, non-existent vacancies, is a very real one and fairly well known to most Australians, and it's been one of the problems that's dogged the education industry ever since the government took over the education industry. It's a situation where a free market arrangement within that industry would be far better, so that things would find their own true level, and we wouldn't have this these artificial situations of oversupply and undersupply from time to time. John, just back on the subject, you mentioned the reasons that caused you to leave. Just sort of at the almost at the last moment before you left, did you have any hesitations? What sort of passed through your mind just in the sort of final few days before you actually left?
Well, leading up to the final decision for us to leave, we had discussed with the teachers' union, and finally I was advised to see Dr. Cairns, because I was told that he was about the only person who could do anything about it, which I did. He wrote a letter for me to the education department, and I believe he asked a question in the house, and there was a situation existing that the regulations didn't seem to cover, and no one seemed to be able to do anything about it. And I was advised that it couldn't be adjusted. I was told at that point that publicity was about the only thing that could help by the teachers' union, so they suggested that I become a union office bearer. So do you mind if I put this in? So the government wouldn't be able to sue me, and then I was introduced to a Mr. Anderson of The Sun, who wrote I think one or two articles on the subject, revealing that this situation did affect many teachers at that time, but who for various reasons, I guess, mainly because of the trouble it involved, and the just almost no hope of having anything done about it. I guess they just didn't bother to take it up with anyone. But the union did try to make an issue of it, but didn't get very far. In fact, the final advice of the union chairman, I think it was to just resign from the department, which I eventually did.
John, had you travelled much before, and did the thought of travelling around the world have much appeal to you?
I had worked in Bougainville on the Consic Rio Tinto copper project as a survey draftsman for a year. I did that actually for one of the 2 years of the required industrial experience for my qualifications, which was a bit rough at the time, but I think very good experience. And then after graduation, I travelled through most of Southeast Asia with a fellow student. I think Asia has held fascination for me for, well, since my early student days. I'd never really considered traveling to Europe, and only recently have I considered moving outside Asia, and I think we'll probably be to America rather than to Europe.
Europe seems to be a thing of the past, I think.
John, it does appear from speaking with many Australians who have travelled that this travelling develops a yardstick of comparison with other countries that most Australians that haven't moved just don't have, and this of course accentuates any elements of dissatisfaction in the status quo as we see it in Australia at the moment. Would you agree with those comments?
I think living in Australia, you're very much insulated from the rest of the world, more so than people who have never left probably realise. As we discussed earlier, I think most of the news of the rest of the world is processed by various news media. You don't have a sort of open reporting system as you do in Hong Kong, where news comes in from all over the world and you're left to make your own judgment about what's going on. Whereas in Australia, everything is prejudged, and although you're receiving news from various countries, you're more or less told how to think about what's going on, which I don't particularly like.
We're led at this point to the Reader's Digest article in the January edition. John, with this 7 years hindsight, is it fair to say that your move from Australia has been to your advantage?
I'd say definitely. Both experience and advancement in my profession. I think I'm doing things now which would be impossible to do in Australia. With my job, the ability to travel throughout the region, with projects that just don't exist in Australia that I can work on up this way, which are quite interesting and exciting. And as well as that, the chance to meet just so many people from all over the world, which is it's like a continuing parade in Hong Kong, because at one time or another most travellers pass through Hong Kong.
John, one thing that worries the average Australian businessman or professional man is the degree of bureaucracy and red tape that's built up around us, and the amount of time most of us spend in filling in these various forms. I believe that type of bureaucracy is virtually non-existent in Hong Kong. Does that contribute to the productivity of professional people here, and does that increase their efficiency, and would that also lead to people reaching a higher standard of performance as well as their efficiency?
Well, I'm a creative person, and the more time I can spend on this side of my business, then of course the better bit my business will be. In Hong Kong, the government seems to maintain a very low profile intentionally. I think to give most of the businessmen the chance to get on with the job, which doesn't seem to me to be the case in Australia. For example, I have a chartered accountant who handles most of the financial workings of my company, and because I travel quite often, and even when I'm in Hong Kong, I work 16 or 20 hour day, which doesn't give me too much time for worrying about red tape.
Traveling in Australia,
John, during your absence from Australia, you've been fortunate enough to have a personal experience in living both in Singapore and Hong Kong. What do you see as the prime differences, or first of all, are there differences, and what are the differences between these main centres of Singapore and Hong Kong?
I guess the main reason would be, and this is a personal thing, I think many foreigners in both countries would feel this. It's the government presence in Singapore and the lack of government presence in Hong Kong. The second reason would be the difference in taxation. Well, in Hong Kong, I think it's around 15%. In Singapore, we were paying about 40%.
John, that's quite interesting. This flat rate of income tax, which is fixed at 15% in Hong Kong, which apparently once you pay it, if it's paid at tax is already paid at company level, it's not again paid at the personal level. That flat rate system does appear to have succeeded in stimulating productivity at all levels. Really, a question I'd like to ask is, do you see any change in the existing very favourable taxation rates in Hong Kong?
I think within the past year, a small increase of something like, is it 2%, was considered. And then rejected because of the competition Hong Kong faces from neighbouring countries such as Korea, Taiwan and the Philippines, and also
John, that's probably an example of how when free market forces are allowed to exert some discipline on the government, as is in effect in Hong Kong, the true situation has to react to competitive forces, as you mentioned, from South Korea, Taiwan and the Philippines. There's no way that the government can sort of override those by introducing tariff protection or other artificial barriers as we have in Australia. Are there any other signs of alarm that might have you might have noticed with respect to any changes on the taxation scene here?
This for the B, thank you. Hong Kong wouldn't last very long at all if the government suddenly decided that it was going to attempt to protect itself by imposing tariffs or duties as the government in Australia does, because in Hong Kong we exist mainly on manufacturing and re-export, and if you impose means of protection such as the ones we've just discussed, you're going to protect yourself against who? things will just dry up. Whereas I think in Australia, a lot of your business is internal. Manufacturing and sales, and to a certain extent you do have to protect yourself against imports from other countries. Is that, would that be correct?
What? John, that is correct, and I think the unfortunate thing is that any protection of this nature that is provided by the government can only be provided at the expense of the actual consumers, and that's at the expense of every Australian that's living in Australia. That's the unfortunate part about it. Recently, Malcolm Fraser guaranteed the Australian car manufacturers 80% of the market. That was a fairly popular comment for him to make,
among those who lived in New South Wales or Victoria or perhaps Adelaide. But to the other people living in the other, several other states that are left in Australia, it's bad news because they appreciate the fact that why should people living in states other than those industrialised states be forced to prop up industries which in a free market economy would no longer be viable. So I agree with you that any tariff supports are only there by grace of the penalties paid by the Australian consumers.
I think the only thing that's worried the local businessmen tax-wise recently in Hong Kong is the introduction of a few gentlemen from Australia who are referred to by American businessmen as the Australian communists.
I see. Where were these gentlemen you mentioned, where were they employed previous to their employment by the Hong Kong tax authorities?
I've no idea. I'm afraid that I have no idea. My only awareness of their being here is from American business associates who are just a bit wary of what's going to happen.
Yeah. At this stage, relate, and we can quote from Mark Tia's recent article about the establishment of an Australian taxation office and the difference between the Swiss Banking Secrecy Act and the Hong Kong banking. We'll just finish off a word from our UK correspondent. Martin, what's the best way to succeed as far as being a taxpayer in the UK?
You leave the UK very quickly with as much money as you can possibly get in a suitcase, but you don't go back. That's about it. If you're stuck in the UK, for example, if you're disabled, the best thing to do is make sure that the rest of your family is disabled or geriatric or otherwise unemployed to make the full benefit of the government tax allowances. If you're a newly married couple, just keep taking the thalidomide. So
just testing this lot, yeah. John, you've had an interesting career and seen much in your lifetime. Could you just give me some background on when you came to Australia and the reason why you came to Australia?
I came to Australia at the latter part of 1961. As the managing director of a multinational American corporation, having previously been the sales director of theirs in London. The arrangement was that I would stay in Australia for 4 or 5 years and then go back to Europe to take up another position. When that time came, my wife and I liked the life in Australia, the freedom, the climate, the general conditions there, and we decided that rather than take the posting back to Europe, that I would resign on the basis that there were so many good things happening in Australia that I ought to be able to earn a living. I went out on my own and did a number of things, and finally, around about 1968, became involved in the euphoria of the mining boom and helped to found a mining company, a mining prospecting company, which was in the main dedicated to prospecting and not to running the stock up and down the market. My colleagues and I, having put our own money into this venture, suddenly realized that in fact we had more going for us than most of the companies that were being floated at that time, and we listed the company on the Sydney Stock Exchange. Looking back on what happened later, it's quite difficult to recall how the excitement of what we were doing, the enthusiasm of myself and my colleagues and the people we gathered around us, but we really felt that we were achieving things for ourselves, obviously as private businessmen, but also for Australia. We had our successes and failures, but in fact came up in a very difficult industry with three viable mining possibilities. We opened up an old mine in northern New South Wales and started shipping ore down to Port Kembla. We're on the brink of success in Western Australia with some gold prospects, and we had a joint venture going with two major companies in New Zealand. Two things happened. Firstly, the recession started throughout the world, which would have to have dampened down the enthusiasm of the mining boom. But secondly, of course, the Whitlam government came in, and that put paid to the hopes of all of us, and eventually brought many of us to the verge of bankruptcy.
John, I guess the Whitlam government brought in a whole new ideological view of the mining industry in general, but what in your mind were the specific things that they did to assist in aborting the prospecting and exploration industry at that stage?
It was, of course, generally a feeling that if you did develop anything, it would be taken away from you. But specifically, as far as the group that I was concerned with were hit by, was firstly the decision by the Federal Treasurer Cairns to abolish the subsidy for gold-producing companies. This occurred just at the time when we were farming out a prospect north of Kalgoorlie on which we had spent $250,000 and which would have been reimbursed to us by a major company who would have paid for the rest of the exploration expenses. They examined the end result from the sale of gold, having deducted the subsidy, and found that they would in fact have gained the princely sum of 5% on the invested funds, and they decided not to continue with it. Well, that was one setback. During just about the same time, in the same year anyway, a decision was taken by the Federal Treasurer to abolish the concessions to the mining prospecting companies under Section 77D of the Income Tax Act. My company had used this correctly in raising funds from investors, and having demonstrated our ability to raise funds from Australian investors, we had gone to London and matched that with investment funds from London. In fact, we lost a potential of $500,000 when the concession was abolished, and that really was the first nail in the coffin of this particular company. However, we still had some backing from one of the major Australian banks, who continued to support us for a further year, and it was only finally when the price of copper declined that the operation went into receivership. It destroyed the aspirations of many good Australians, not only Australians, we had some Germans and we had some English people, and we were rather a happy band of brothers who were not engaged in running stocks up and down, as I mentioned before, although we had no objection to making our fortunes, if such was our luck.
John, what were your prime dissatisfactions in Australia, both personal and business, at the time you decided to leave?
It seemed to me, having lived through the period of post-war England, where there was a complete reluctance on the part of anybody to do a day's work, and the feather bedding by governments and it seemed to me that this was occurring again in Australia, and I regretfully say largely as a result of the shop stewards and the Pommy migrants who'd come out to Australia. And it just purely by chance, after the mining venture ceased to operate, I had the opportunity of coming up here with another company, an Australian company, which had a contract in Hong Kong. And within a matter of days, one suddenly felt the enthusiasm of people who are prepared to work and who are living, 4.5 million Chinese people living under very adverse conditions. They seem to have a more hopeful attitude to life than the people living in Sydney or London, who had far greater comforts but less joie de vivre, if I may use that expression. I don't know the Cantonese for it.
John, I, in my involvement as a in the Chamber of Commerce, we received a regular circular from the Hong Kong Trade Development Council, and it simply suggested that Australian businessmen should look at establishing some form of operation in Hong Kong, because as they explained, Hong Kong was different to Australia, and their words were, in Hong Kong we welcome businessmen and we encourage profits. I think the way they put it certainly enthuses the average businessman. Now, with your experience, having been in Hong Kong since 1975, would you say that's a fair comment, that they actually welcome businessmen and encourage profits?
Yes, that certainly is so. It isn't, of course, a 100% rosy picture. Let's put the pluses first. You have a stable labour force, a hard-working labour force, a labour force which is prepared to learn from the limited number of expatriates that you have to bring in. The cost of materials stays reasonably stable, but depending on your industry, you do have shortages and difficulties of bringing stuff in from overseas. From a manufacturer's point of view, you have a very, very great problem in finding suitable premises. The government are trying to overcome this with the Taipo industrial estates, where they're going to encourage the erection of low-rise factory buildings. Up to now, Hong Kong has developed largely on the textile industry and has been able to put people into high-rise lettable factory space, which is totally unsuitable for most European or Australian or American types of manufacture. For instance, you have a 7'6" clearance under the beam and a 10-foot ceiling height, and if you put a large Australian there, he's inclined to crack his head on the ceiling every time he goes by. The other problem you have is the high cost of keeping what are called Europeans, whether they come from Australia, America or Europe. You have to pay them about the same basic rate that they would get in their own country, and then you have to double that in order to cover the cost of 18-month holidays for themselves and their families, the high cost of accommodation, which is probably going to go higher because the mass transit railway have brought a lot of Europeans into Hong Kong, and they are tending to force the rates, the rental rates for accommodation up. It is too expensive for the ordinary executive to buy his own apartment in Hong Kong. The price of food is probably comparable with Sydney if you take it across the board. Some things are cheaper, probably the buying of a second-hand car is cheaper. You probably spend a little more money on entertaining your family, because you haven't got the freedom of going onto the beach or driving out into the bush to have a barbecue. There's more false entertainment, eating out in restaurants and such things of that sort. Probably to sum up my attitude, I liked living in Australia. I liked the spaciousness of it. I would quite like to go back if conditions changed there. But in the meantime, to anybody who's been engaged in private enterprise in its proper sense, Hong Kong is a tremendous challenge. Nobody gives you anything. You've got to go out and get it yourself. But if you do make it, then the rewards are there. in money, in low taxation, and in the satisfaction of achievement. And although particularly Labour delegations from the United Kingdom deplore the standard of living of many people in Hong Kong, and it certainly is true that the standards are low, in the 2 years I've been here, the wages both for building labourers and office staff have gradually crept up. Each year a little bit more is done, and it wouldn't surprise me in a decade if the ordinary man in the street in Hong Kong wasn't living on a higher standard of living than anyone in Sydney or in Bradford in England in comparable circumstances.
Yeah, John, just to finish off, what about some advice to any Australian fellows who are contemplating shifting to Hong Kong? What options are there available for the types of lifestyles that they can elect and choose in Hong Kong when they shift here?
I think there are probably three alternatives. Either you do what any good Australian would like to do, and that is to be a rebel. And that really isn't a very good idea, because we are here as guests of the Chinese community, if I can put it in a strange way. The middle of the road path is probably the best, and I'll finish up with that. The extreme at the other end is to imitate the English, endeavour to become a member of the Hong Kong club, wear your old school tie at all times, and endeavour to be invited to cocktails by Mr. Newbiggin of Jardine's. That is totally unnecessary unless that's what you want. If you just conform quietly to the standards adopted by most Europeans in Hong Kong, if you endeavour to understand the different attitude of mind of your Chinese friends, try, I think, to build up some rapport with them. And it's quite difficult to do this, because they're a very ancient civilization and they regard us all as being slightly mad, but it is possible and very enjoyable if you can achieve that.
Robin, this is an interview with Mr. Philip Day, but just stay with the Christian names, if there's any names mentioned throughout things. Philip, it's been said that the bureaucrats in some Asian countries, this I don't think would include Hong Kong, but say some other Asian countries in Southeast Asia, have a distinct difference of motivation between them and the bureaucrats in a country like Australia. It's been said that the Australian bureaucrat is not interested in receiving money or graft. He's only interested in an ideological aspiration of blocking progress, or telling business people or entrepreneurs and just how things can't be done and why they can't be done that way, and generally blocking them. Will this be a fair comment, and how does this fit in with the style of limited bureaucracy in Hong Kong?
Well, I guess that's a fair comment. It's certainly the case in many countries in Southeast Asia that money opens doors and things are done. Whether in fact this is morally an acceptable practice or not is perhaps questionable, but one has to look at the practical side of things, and if you're prepared to meet the basic demands to get things done by paying graft or commissions, or as we sometimes refer to it in Hong Kong, tea money to bureaucrats, then this really becomes a cost of sale, a cost of doing the business. It's true to say that in certain countries you can't get things done unless you do this. As far as Hong Kong's concerned, this has been a practice for many, many years. In fact, it's always been a practice of the Chinese that money will open doors, money will get things done, and so Hong Kong has had this. Unfortunately, it's gone into certain areas of government where problems have occurred because of it, namely crime prevention and so on. Recently, an organisation was set up here in Hong Kong, the Independent Commission Against Corruption, and one of its prime aims was to cut out the bribery and corruption which was affecting the crime prevention activities of the police force. To date, I guess this has been fairly successful. But it is rather interesting to note that the local Chinese here would look upon the ICAC, as it's known, as rather an intrusion into some of their traditional business activities when it does move in those areas. And in fact, it goes by another name to many of us who live here, or it's called by another name, and that is the ICAC is known as Interrupting Chinese Ancient Custom.
Philip, what really triggered your move out of Australia to Hong Kong, and when did this happen?
Well, a job opportunity arose, which the way it was put to me, compared to the opportunities as I saw them at the time in Australia, I really couldn't refuse it, from a personal advancement point of view, but also from the monetary point of view. It was becoming increasingly difficult with tax burdens based on a tax scale which was relative perhaps 15 years ago to incomes, with inflation rampant the way it was becoming increasingly difficult not just to just to make ends meet, really, let alone try and get ahead and build up some basis of personal financial security. I cannot see at the moment how a young couple in Australia, for example, is going to, within the next 10 years, have the opportunity to achieve what has worldwidely been known as the Great Australian Dream, and that is owning their own home. They're burdened with very high tax rates, even though both of them may be earning an income. They're burdened with almost extortionary interest rates on their loans, and they're also facing a problem in meeting the margin between the value of the house and the maximum allowable loan that can be granted from the better lending institutions who are prepared to lend their money at a slightly more generous interest rate. And so there's so many things today in Australia that for young people, it's becoming more and more difficult for them to get ahead. And this was one of the reasons I looked at my position. I saw the opportunity. It's a chance for perhaps 5 years to work in another environment, to work in an environment where people work and are paid in relation to their work and their ability, and not as we're finding in Australia today, where people are paid, and if you're lucky, you get some work out of them.
Absolutely.
Philip, in Australia, the Australian government now and their dreaded tax department always appears to refer to Hong Kong as a tax haven, in a fairly derogatory sense. How do you feel about this term being used in relation to Hong Kong, now having lived here?
Well, I think it's quite ludicrous, really, because people in Hong Kong do pay taxes. They pay taxes at what I consider to be realistic rates. The fact that personal income tax cannot exceed a maximum of 15%, and the fact that corporate tax at the moment is 17% on income earned in or derived from activities in Hong Kong, and offshore income is non-taxable. This, I think, is a very realistic way of approaching the tax requirements. It still enables people to have an incentive to work harder, to make more money. And this obviously reflects in the productivity that's achieved in a place like Hong Kong, where people work industriously and the rates of productivity increase as time goes on. And we therefore find that even where we do have worldwide inflation, where a place like Hong Kong is very dependent on its imports of raw materials, it's dependent on its imports of basically everything, foodstuffs and so on, we still are able to achieve what I consider to be a very excellent real growth rate of between 6 to 7%, only achieved because of the fact that people are working and productivity increases, and they are doing this because the incentives are there. They know that the extra dollar that they earn is still only going to be taxed at 15%. It's not going to be taxed at an extra 5% marginal above their base rate or something like this.
Well, I think you've certainly explained why the Australian government could perhaps be somewhat embarrassed by having this very interesting yardstick of comparison so close to Australia, and this is perhaps why they are tempted to downgrade the real energy that's developed within Hong Kong just simply by the incentives that still exist here and no longer exist in Australia. One of the reasons put to me, Philip, for virtually no inflation in Hong Kong is the discipline existing on the printing of new money here. And that's something we rather envy in Australia. Are there other reasons for the tremendous example set by the Hong Kong currency, which now has emerged as the fourth strongest currency in the world? I'll just ask you now if you have any other comments on what else it may be.
How are you doing? Yeah, there are several reasons. Productivity, obviously, is one of the reasons. Take, for example, when the OPEC countries raised their oil prices, began to raise their oil prices dramatically over the last few years. Hong Kong, 2 years ago, virtually had a zero inflation rate, or very close to it. When you look at the practical aspects of that, Hong Kong's power is virtually 100% derived from the burning of fuel oil. The electricity that's required in the service industries in Hong Kong and in the industries of Hong Kong is enormous. But people in Hong Kong recognize the problem, just increased their productivity, and so were able to overcome the additional cost that had been forced upon them by external forces. I think there's one other very important factor in Hong Kong, and that is that Hong Kong really would come as close to the economist's dream of a laissez-faire economic system. Certainly, true laissez-faire system is obviously not possible, but Hong Kong comes very close to it. And so you have the normal market forces of supply and demand running in this market, where competition amongst manufacturers, amongst retailers and so on is enormous. There are no restrictions, or very few restrictions and very few restraints. So you get the normal market situation evolving, and when people are working harder to outdo each other and so on, then this all reflects back in what happens to the costs, and this shows up in the ability to keep inflation down, even though we do have increased costs in raw materials and foodstuffs and so on. Hong Kong basically relying on imports for most of its raw materials, for 98% of its foodstuffs. So I think really it all gets back to the two things, the laissez-faire economic environment and certainly the productivity of the people at work here.
Okay. Philip, in Australia, one of the impressive duties foisted onto the employers by the government is that the government forces them to perform in this role of unpaid thief by dipping into the pay packets of their employees and taking out this group tax or pay-as-you-earn tax. It's a pretty onerous task for employers to have to do, and that the average person in Australia, the average wage payer, never ever comes in contact with the taxation department other than just getting his rebate check back once per year. What's the equivalent situation as it exists in Hong Kong?
Well, the position in Hong Kong is very simple. It's not an onerous task from the point of view of the company. An employer here is required to submit a declaration of salaries and wages paid to their staff during the taxable period, and that's where the basic obligation of the company begins and ends. From there on in, the amount of money owed by the employee to the tax department or by the tax department to the employee in the form of refunds is entirely a matter between the tax department and the employee, and the company will not, under most circumstances, become involved. So it is a direct face-to-face situation between the salary or wage earner and the Bureau of Inland Revenue.
I noticed in this morning's South China Morning Post. Fairly unfavourable reaction to Australia's suggestion of increasing their tariff protection even further than at the present time. What really is the problem back in Australia that it requires this type of protection against competition?
Well, before I answer that, I'd just like to say that the unfavourable attitude towards Australian protectionism through quotas and tariffs is very strong throughout the region. We had a situation, for example, in the Philippines last year where, because of the quota system and tariffs on textiles, there was almost an embargo on Australian imports or imports of Australian products into the Philippines. One can understand why people in this area feel this way. When you look at where the main strength of the economies lie, and that is on manufacturing goods that are required for reasonably developed capitalist-style economies. And they can do it more efficiently, more cheaply, and produce possibly a better product than it's possible to do in Australia. On the other hand, we, as an exporter, look at Asia, and the Asian population, the Asian market, as being potentially an enormous market for Australian goods. And so on the one hand, we're coming to Asia and we're saying, buy our product, we need to buy it, we need to sell. And we're screaming because people are imposing quotas on certain items that we're wishing to export. Yet on the other hand, where people are trying to export to Australia the manufactured goods, we're throwing up barriers to protect our own inefficient industries as fast as we can. You ask me what can be done. I think this gets back to the same basic problem. People have got to learn to do an honest day's work for a good day's pay, not to be paid to sit around and have sick leave and unemployment benefits and things like this. And if they're not prepared to do a good day's work for an honest day's pay, then the system has to be changed whereby these people can be replaced and readily replaced by others who have incentives to work, want to work. We have what I consider to be a an untenable situation going right throughout Australia today, where the unions are demanding total unionisation of industry, or total unionisation of a production unit, a factory, something like that. Surely the individual has got a right to make a choice whether he wants to be a member of the union or not. But once you get total unionisation, you get so much protection for those who don't want to work, put up by the unions, which has been fostered in the past to some degree by government policies. So people have just got to learn to work. They've got to learn to be competitive. We've got to stop thinking that that we have a great lifestyle and it's our undeniable right to enjoy this lifestyle. We've got to work to protect it. People in this part of the world work hard. They're striving to achieve more, and in doing so, they are improving their standard of living, and they're improving the range of products, the quality of products that they're producing, and they're increasing their productivity and remaining competitive in world markets. We in Australia don't look at things on this lab.
Thanks, Philip. I've met a great number of Australians during this trip up here, and none of them have anything adverse to say against Australia itself as a country. In fact, they're all greatly excited about Australia's potential and saddened by the way the country is just being ground to a halt. Any derogatory comments they have to make are, of course, made toward our political and bureaucratic overlords, so to speak. I'm wondering, with all these expatriate Australians here gathered in this one centre, is there anything that could be done by you all here to assist Australia from something of a distance?
Yeah. Well, there are many things I suppose that we can do. It's a matter of whether anybody is prepared to listen to them when we do them, and that's part of the problems that Australia faces today. I think that as Australians working here, knowing what can be done and what can be achieved, and there are sufficient of us here now to do something like this, we should be working together as a unified group to try and make government and others in Australia aware of the problems that some of these decisions are causing us in our business activities. I've mentioned how difficult it is in some places in Asia to sell Australian products because of the tariff barriers that have been put up for products from these countries going into Australia. We need to take a more active part in lobbying and trying to make government see reason over some of the actions that they're doing and reverse them. It's not easy. The lobbies in Australia at the moment tend to be very, very strong in favour of protectionism, and they seem to be holding sway with the government. Now, whether as individuals we can do this, whether we need to form into a group to do it, this is something which we have to decide. But quite frankly, something does have to be done, and something has to be done in the near future.
Philip, in your almost 3 years living in Hong Kong, how many times have you had the opportunity to revisit Australia, and what has been your feeling on returning to Australia, and again your feeling on returning to Hong Kong?
Well, I've had the opportunity to go back on quite a few occasions. I think the first occasion gave me the greatest shock because it was after some 6 or 7 months here, and I had become used to the conditions of business in a place like Hong Kong, as well as other parts of Asia, where people work hard and one can get things done, and if you're energetic and you like to have a reaction in a similar vein from people that you're dealing with, well, this is the place that you can get it. it appalled me, quite honestly, when I was first back, at the rapid change, what appeared rapid to me, in people's attitude towards work. I suppose this had been going on around me for quite some time, while I hadn't recognized it when I was living there before I came up here. But after having been away for some 6 or 7 months, and going back, this became far more noticeable, where it was difficult to get people to do things. People tended to be 9-to-5ers. If you wanted something done, well, okay, it'll get done in some time, but it'll be our time, not yours, not when you want it, and so on. Whereas here in Hong Kong, we find if we want to get something done, it can be done within a matter of hours. If not within hours, then within a few days. And it, particularly if you're dealing with people in business to have decisions made, this is terribly important in Hong Kong because of the competition again. If the person you're dealing with doesn't make a quick decision, maybe one of his competitors will and beat him to it. So I must confess that I left Australia after the first trip back feeling very depressed, and I was delighted to come back to Hong Kong, to arrive back here on a Sunday, knowing that on the Monday I was going to get back into an environment where I was going to be happy working and where I could achieve something and achieve it reasonably quickly and effectively without having to cut through the attitudes of workers, the red tape and so on, which Australia seems to be building up at the moment.
No, what about your reaction on returning to?
Well, you don't want to quote that, do you?
Oh. Well, I thought it was a good one.
I would say, however, that I don't wish to be considered to be one of those good Australian knockers. I've had the opportunity in the last 15 years of seeing many countries around the world. I still consider Australia to be one of the greatest countries in the world, and we do have so much going for it. And I certainly intend to return there when is uncertain, hopefully when attitudes change a little bit. And when I feel that I can go back and get satisfaction out of working in an environment similar to the satisfaction I get working in an environment such as we have in Hong Kong. What does disturb me greatly is sitting up here as an Australian and seeing people in this area looking at Australia from the outside and laughing at us and saying, look, you've got it all, but you're a great bunch of fools because you don't know how to handle it and what to do with it. And this is very disturbing. If you look at it from that point of view, you might ask yourself, how long is it going to be before they decide we don't know what to do with it and they come down and try and do something with it themselves?
Philip, I know many Australians are getting to the stage where they fear to pick up the morning or evening newspaper because our newspapers read like a catalogue of disasters. I don't get this feeling here in Hong Kong. I'm quite enthused after having put a newspaper down about just what's happening in the actual world coverage. I wonder if I could just ask a quick comment on you what the essential difference is in our press, or apparently.
Well, I suppose you can say that a lot of Australian press is based on the Murdoch edict of sensationalism sells newspapers. But that's not the fact here, really, because, yes, certainly there are one or two sensationalist-style newspapers by comparison with the others here in Hong Kong. These don't come anywhere near the same style of the sensationalist papers we have in Australia. Therefore, we don't have these so-called disasters and so on blown up out of all proportion. I think it's probably fair to say, too, that certainly we don't have anywhere near the same problems that in Hong Kong that you have in Australia at the moment that the papers can latch onto. But generally speaking, the standard of the media in Hong Kong is excellent. It's servicing a diversified requirement here of people from all over the world. It's keeping them in touch with happenings all over the world. It has a very extroverted approach towards reporting, whereas in Australia I feel, in keeping with a lot of other attitudes, the press is becoming terribly introverted in what it's doing and what it's saying. We're far more in Australia, we're far more interested in what's happening in our own little neck of the woods. People need to get out and look at the real world, because the attitude we have in Australia at the moment, people are just quite unaware of what's happening in the real world, whereas in Hong Kong the real world is all around us. It's what keeps us. It's the world of business, the world of commerce, the world of politics, and it's what happens on the other side of the world can very dramatically affect what is going to happen in Hong Kong. Perhaps not just certainly politically, but certainly economically, and therefore the press is catering for this need, as the Australian press should be catering for this need in Australia, but unfortunately at the moment it is not.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Philip.